Welcome to Tuesday's Richie Allen radio programme. How you doing? It's 5 o'clock. It's 5 o'clock. 5 of the clock. With you for the next 2 hours. Got a brilliant guest lined up for you as well today. I'm a little bit croaky, but you'll forgive me that. I think let's do Tuesday's programme.
It's the BBG, not the BBC. You're listening to the Richie Allen radio show, live from Salford in Greater Manchester.
It's the Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Yes, I had a brilliant conversation back in December with a nurse called Jenny Lowes. Jenny worked in the NHS for some years, recruited for the NHS, is now working overseas. She's in Portugal in private practice. Can't wait to catch up with her again. We'll do that in the second hour. Before that, though, you and me are going to have a chat. That's what we're going to do. Do tweet me, as I say this every day. It's at BBG Richie. That's where you'll find me on Twitter. And I will read those tweets out during the course of this hour. So get in touch. Do it right now. Yeah, a little bit croaky. I don't know why that is. I've not been shouting at anybody. I haven't. I'm still a bit under the weather. But I'm all right, I'm here. I'm here with you, that's all that matters. It's Tuesday, March 23rd, in the year of our Lord, 2021. Eh? 1 year to the day that Boris Johnson told us all to stay at home. Remember, it'll be for 3 weeks, he said. It'll be to flatten the curve, he said. I didn't believe him, and I'm pretty sure that you didn't believe him either. I think you didn't believe him either. Right? And as last year dragged on and we learned of the miracle mRNA vaccines that would be produced at record speed, I think we knew, didn't we, that this would go on and on and on and on and it wouldn't ever really stop at all, even if everybody did have a coronavirus vaccine. Here we are now, 12 months on, 1 year to flatten the curve. And you might know, you might have seen this today, there was a minute's silence today, led by both Houses of Parliament, England, Wales, House of Lords, staged as usual. Doctors and nurses were standing solemnly. How do I say? Can I even solemnly? Solemnly, that's right. Politicians. And apparently there's a vigil this evening at 8 o'clock UK time for the nation. Collective reflection, collective grieving. People are being asked tonight at 8 o'clock to stand in their doorways with a light source of some sort or other, a candle or a torch or a phone or something. It'll be a phone for most people. That sense of occasion, of drama, of being a part of it is very important. I spoke about this last year. That sounds very self-congratulatory, doesn't it? Well, I spoke of this last year. No, I don't mean it to sound like that. I talk about this all the time. There was this great excitement around this time last year. You might remember it. People were caught up in it, weren't they? Felt like they were starring in, or at least part of the supporting cast, of some real-life drama. Something they'd only previously seen on television or in the movies. People felt they were involved. And I think that was important to those behind the scam, because it is a scam. I think most people's lives are fairly mundane. I'll never say boring. Maybe I shouldn't say mundane. Maybe I should say routine. I think most people's lives are fairly routine. We get up in the morning. We shit, shower and shave. Some of us get the kids to school and then rush off to the office. Others don't have any kids at all and make the commute on their own. We come home. We open a bottle of wine, because we're all functioning alcoholics, whether we like to admit it or not. Not all of us. Most of us. We binge watch stuff on Netflix or Amazon Monday to Thursday. Drink a bottle of wine and feck off to the labba, off to the bed. And we go out at weekends. We drink too much then. Hangover on Sunday. And a roast dinner is cooked, usually by herself. And then the whole thing starts again. My old mate David Icke used to call it the hamster wheel. Not boring, not mundane maybe, but routine. Routine. It's the routine that'll kill you in the end. And I think this time last year, this was very exciting for so many people. They were glad to be caught up in it, at least for the first little while anyway. Jesus, this is a bit scary, eh? But it's new though. It's new. Hey, it's new. This is exciting. Exciting stuff, this is what it is. And that played a part in the first few months in terms of getting people to cooperate with this. I mean, they must have known on some level that this was monumental bollocks. They must have. On some sensory level, they must have been aware that, well, we're being scammed. But they could actively take part in it. On social media, they could make their own TikTok videos. They could run around like Egypts, clapping for the NHS and for those on the front line. Now that's important as well. Terms like front line and the images that were conjured up in people's minds by such terminology, the front line. Even today, I heard commentators on television talking about getting PPE to the front line. You know, it evokes images of doctors and nurses facing a mortal enemy on some mythical fantasy line, trenches. They're in there fighting the killer virus. And lockdown, terminology that was, I suppose, it came out of the US prison system. Lockdown, the front line. It was all very dramatic. And of course, the media played its part in selling the drama. I've done a lot on that. I've written about it extensively. The 24-hour media companies and what it is they do. It's sophisticated on the one hand, and on the other hand, it isn't very sophisticated at all. And that's how it's worked for the best part of the last 12 months, I think. I think now, March 23rd, 2021, I think people are largely fed up of it, and they just can't wait to go back to the mundane. You know, give me the commute back. Give me the screaming kids in the back seat of the Prius. Give me footy with the lads, Saturday drinks with the missus of the evening, hungover Sunday mornings and roast dinners on Sunday evenings, and then back to start it all over again on Monday. Give it back to me, please. I can't take any more of this feckin' nightmare. And of course, out of that follows, give me the jab, give me the jab, give me three jabs just to be on the safe side. I'll wear the masks while swimming in the Mediterranean if you let me go on me holidays. The stable is closed behind these people. The stable door. Maybe the time to resist was last March, maybe. Maybe there's still time. I don't know. I'll be reading your tweets as we go along. Lots to talk about this hour. It is the Richie Allen Radio Show for Tuesday, March 23rd. And I'm going to kick off with a tune because there's a lot of talk to come. This is the Blue Oyster Cult and Don't Fear the Reaper on the Richie Allen Show. Let's leave it there. There's so much to get through. Boris Johnson is on his feet in Downing Street. I'll bring you some of that if any of it is relevant or interesting to you. I'll do that. Vaccinators in Leicester. This is on richieallen.co.uk. Six articles, I think, posted there today. Some interesting stuff on there. I posted this afternoon. Vaccinators could be going door to door in Leicester to persuade... Yes, stop the music, son. That'll do you. All right, we're getting the mistakes in early. Yeah, vaccinators could go door to door in Leicester to persuade people to have a COVID jab, to persuade them to have the jab, right? Why is this? Well, COVID cases are high in some parts of the city where, amazingly, vaccine uptake has been low. Right? Slow, even. So, officials in the city have been speaking to the BBC and they've said, look, we're thinking of some innovative ways to help us reach more people. So, persuaders. Now, we talked about persuaders a few months ago. I wrote about this on richieallen.co.uk. Councils around the country said that where people have declined a jab, they might be paid a visit by a persuader. Persuader would knock on the door and say, ah, go on, have the vaccine now. Ah, go on. Go on, have the vaccine. Go on, go on, go on. Think of other people, kind of a thing, right? Okay. Today, though, Leicestershire and Rutland City Clinical Commissioning Group, or CCG, they've said that, yes, we are seriously thinking of sending vaccinators to places where the rates are really low. So somebody armed with vaccines would presumably knock on the door and say, I've got a vaccine handy if you fancy it, kind of a thing. You know what I mean? So, yeah, it gives you all sorts of mental images, that, doesn't it? Eh?
Sarah Connor?
Yes?
Oh, what an atmosphere. I love a party with a happy atmosphere.
And Sarah gets vaccinated then by the vaccinator, and all is well. That ends well. This isn't a joke, by the way. Vaccinators will be deployed in Leicester. Go around there to Mrs. Murphy or Mr. Smith there on, I don't know, Acacia Avenue. Why, they've said they don't want a vaccine. Here's some vaccines. Knock on their door and you know, they might just have one, kind of a thing. I'm guessing vaccinators are going to meet a lot of bored and lonely women and men. Could be a good career move, maybe. I'm thinking Pat Mustard now, kind of a thing. Pat Mustard, you know. It could be. Could be the new milkman. Could be the new milkman. I might become a vaccinator myself, but I won't give any vaccines. I'll give a different type of injection, if you know what I mean. Jesus Christ. Oh, God. I haven't had a drink now. No, no. Later. Not now. This is where we are now, eh? Vaccinators. Vaccinators. Dun, 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 the vaccinator. Yeah. Yeah, it'll catch on. It'll catch on. EastEnders, then. Like Coronation Street, is a national treasure. It's a national treasure. So it is. We talked about Corrie on the programme the other day, didn't we? On one of the programmes, I can't remember what I did this morning. Anyway, there was an interesting scene in last night's edition of EastEnders. That is the edition for Tuesday, March 22nd. Very interesting. This scene is genuine now. This is from last night's EastEnders. And it takes place in a convenience store, a 7-Eleven. And a woman is there behind the counter. She's a very pretty Asian lady. In walks a black dude with a Caribbean accent. And they kind of talk about the vaccine. This is genuinely from EastEnders last evening.
Good morning. What a wonderful day.
Not in my house. Oh, kids. You'd have him. You won the lottery?
Oh, yeah, man. You could say that again. Got my second vaccination?
Already? Oh, good for you. I'm due my first one later today. I'm calling it my superpower. Make me that bit more invincible.
Science is a wonderful thing, you know.
Oh, rather you than me.
Oh, don't tell me. You're one of them anti-vaxxers.
Oh, you must admit they pushed it through too quick. Lab rats, that's what we are. No, I ain't having any of that rubbish pumped into me. 20 me fags, please.
She's asked for cigarettes.
Dolly Parton, she can say what she likes. I mean, normally I'm with her all the way, but who knows what it's going to do to us in 5-10 years' time.
Dolly Parton can say what she likes. Normally I'm with her, but who knows what the vaccine will do to us in 5 or 10 years' time. That's good. The other two people in the shop are not impressed.
Well, let me tell you what I do know. Last year, I was lying down in a hospital bed gasping for breath. Thought it was all over. I wouldn't wish that on my worst enemy. COVID, man, it'll kill you faster than them fags.
Some of the best scientists have worked on this. But you reckon you know better? How's that PhD working out for you, Karen?
Yeah, well, I've got plenty of time to think about it, you know, being much younger than you.
Oh, well, you want to worry about getting to my age if you carry on thinking like that.
So there.
After everything we've been through this year, can't help some people.
Can't help some people. Poor old Karen, the sceptic, doesn't want the vaccine. And she's put in her place by her neighbours in the convenience store. That's from an episode of EastEnders that went out last night. The full episode can be seen on the BBC iPlayer. That is pure, undiluted propaganda. By anybody's definition. And I'll just leave that there and say no more about it. At BBG Richie, I'd be interested to know if you're in Ireland and you watch Fairly Shitty, otherwise known as Fair City, which is a soap that goes out on RTE television, or any other country, like Australia, any other English-speaking country, that is. Are your soap operas, your daytime soaps, or your evening soaps, are they engaging in such garbage? Are they? Are they putting together these little scenes where an anti-vaccine or an anti-vaxxer gets put in their place? Eh? I don't know. It's all a bit mad. 17 minutes past 5 o'clock. Richie Allen Show. Nurse Jenny Lowes will be on the programme a bit later on. Natalie says, regarding EastEnders, my jaw is on the floor. So was mine when I was sent a link to the clip this morning. Molly says, what shitty script writing, apart from the propaganda, says Molly. Presumably you're a script writer, Molly. I don't know. It sounded all right to me, even for propaganda, but what would I know about it? Angela says, Coronation Street is full of propaganda. I've lost count of how many times people have ended up in hospital where the COVID notices are everywhere. That's Corrie, says Angela. Ron, who's approaching 80. How you doing, Ron? Richie, I say that, Ron, because you said it yourself. As you know, Richie, they put me on the decline list, but today they texted me again to offer me an appointment. They do not give up. They do not give up, says Ron. Tell you what, Ron, this is going to be you, son, in a couple of weeks' time. Are you Ron? Yes. It'll be the vaccinator. It'll be an atmosphere. Vaccinator coming to a town near you. Mad Monk tweets, door-to-door sales from your government. I wonder if these persuaders are on commission. Oh, while we are here, have you paid your BBC licences, Mad Monk? Ruth is listening in Brisbane, friend of mine. How you doing, Ruth? Right back at you, kid. Nice to know you're listening. It must be very late in the evening in Brisbane there, or early Wednesday morning. Hi to Jean Mulcahy. How you doing, Jean? Jean says, all the last year has shown us is how devoid the average person is of common sense and the ability to think critically. Maybe a culling isn't such a bad idea. Give over, Jean. Give over, son. We don't need to cull anybody. That's the way they think. That's the way they think, man. Get your vibration up there in the stratosphere, my friend. Hi to Ollie, who says, Richie, please can you shout out to my dad, Adrian, for putting me onto you a few years ago. I've been listening ever since. Ollie, who's in Cambridge and says he's 22, his dad, Adrian, put him onto this programme. Adrian, how are you? Thanks for sharing the programme. And Ollie, you're very welcome. Nice to meet you, my friend. Even if it's only across the old Twitter thing. And hi to Andy Newman as well, and to Gail, and to Kimmy, and everybody else who's listening to the programme this afternoon. Let's check in with Downing Street. Let's check right in with 10 Downing Street and see if Boris Johnson said something that might be of any interest to me and you. Now, I doubt it will be. But in light of everything that's going on, here's Johnson speaking a short time ago, saying that after a struggle unlike any other in his lifetime, quote, jab by jab, this country is on the path to reclaiming our freedoms. Here is the barrel of monkey spunk himself.
When people come to describe this epidemic to future generations, we'll tell the story of the heroes of the NHS and social care, of pharmacists, teachers, armed service personnel, shop workers, transport workers, the police, and so many others. But in the end, this was unlike any other struggle in my lifetime, in that our entire population has been engaged. And it's thanks to all of you, therefore, that we can continue on our roadmap to freedom. We will meet our targets, offering a first dose to everyone over 50 by the middle of next month, as well as those under 50 who are clinically vulnerable, and offering a first dose of vaccine to every adult by the end of July. And cautiously but irreversibly, step by step, jab by jab, this country is on the path to reclaiming our freedoms.
There you are now. That was the Prime Minister a short time ago. Jab by jab, this country is on its way to reclaiming our freedoms. The freedoms are taken away by Boris Johnson, not by any respiratory infection. Okay. All right. Mandatory vaccines then for care workers. Wrote about this today on richieallen.co.uk. Matt Hancock, the Health Secretary, and the Prime Minister you just heard, Boris Johnson, they want to change the law and make it mandatory for care workers to have a jab. That would make it the first time since the early 19th century that a vaccine had been mandated or would be mandated. You might remember, you might know your history. Back in the early 1800s, babies had to have Jenner's smallpox jab. No choice. Mums were told they had to have it. like it's her lumpet. Okay. It's dystopian and all the rest of it, of course. The idea that healthcare workers would be told they can't have a job any longer if they don't take a experimental mRNA medicine that could kill them. Of course it's dystopian. Here's the utterly useless Matt Hancock speaking on Sky News this morning. They call him the health secretary on the mandating of the jab for the care workers. Here he is, Hancock.
Well, no decisions have been taken. As you know, we have a task force looking at the question of certification, of whether there's things that you need to be able to show that you've had a vaccine or indeed a test in order to be able to do. That looks both at these questions around international travel, but is also looking at the question of whether, in order to be able to care for people professionally, then you ought to have protected yourself so that you can't infect others. This is something that happens already. For instance, doctors have to have the hepatitis B vaccine, and it's clearly something that has important moral questions on mm-hmm. on both sides. So it is something that we're looking at, but no decisions have yet been taken.
Important moral questions, important legal questions as well. I mean, you would presumably expect a decision such as this to be challenged in the court. So on that basis, are you currently looking at vaccination, not simply of those who work in care homes, but perhaps mandatory vaccination for, as you put it just a moment ago, people working in care, people caring, which could generally apply to quite a lot of people in the health service as well?
Yes. Vaccinate them all then, says Neil Patterson, eh? Vaccinate all those working in medicine or care. What does Hancock say?
Well, as I say, this already is the case in terms of hepatitis B in the NHS for doctors. So there is a clear precedent for this proposition. At the moment, what we're looking at is for those who work in care homes, elderly care homes, on the grounds that they are the most vulnerable to this disease. That's why they were in the very first cohort of the groups to be vaccinated. It's something that some care homes have actually called for, because it would require a change in the law through secondary legislation. And therefore, I entirely understand why some care homes, wanting to take that duty of care over those who are in that home for the residents, are keen for us to be able to take this step, so that they can require people who could otherwise pass on the virus to take the vaccine.
There is, of course, a kind of fairly big question that follows all of this, that if we are actively considering mandatory vaccination if you want to work in a care setting, could we consider mandatory vaccination more generally in the population at large? I mean, the JCVI modelling showed us, I think it was at the tail end of last week, the ideal percentage targets for vaccination. And we're looking at 75% coverage in under 50s when we get to that stage. That is a big target. Now, if we're not coming close to that target, are there circumstances in which you could see mandatory vaccination for people under the age of 50?
Oh, yeah. That presenter, Neil Patterson, asking him why not consider mandating the vaccine for everybody else. That little bastard has Kay Burley's job, believe it or not.
Fabulous.
It's all good.
So I naturally loathe him. Why not mandate for everybody then, Hancock?
No, we've ruled that out for the general population. And there's a difference, which is if you as a profession care for people and are therefore in very close contact with them, then that is different to the general population. On these percentages, they are important. The uptake amongst the groups that we're vaccinating is unbelievably high, over 95% now in the most elderly groups. And for care home workers, where it is a bit lower, it is now greater than 75%. In elderly care homes, amongst staff who've been vaccinated, amongst residents, it's over 90%. So these take-up rates are Sorry to interrupt.
We've got so much to get through, and I think the point in terms of vaccination in care homes has been made. But there will be people looking at the rate of progress that we are making in terms of vaccinations and wondering why the government is bringing forward, you know, fines of £5,000 for people who head abroad without good excuse. I mean,
yeah, that's coming in from Monday. If you want to leave this country from next Monday, you can't do so unless you've got a so-called valid reason. Attempting to leave the country without a valid reason will result in you being fined £5,000. Fucking hell. We'll leave that one there for the moment. Just before we do, though, Dr. Raghib Ali, I think I pronounced that right, Raghib Ali, is a consultant in acute care. He's all in favour of having the jabs forced on care workers. Here he is in conversation with Talk Radio's Julia Hartley Brewer.
So as doctors, we have to be vaccinated for hepatitis B. So that's been the case for many years. Even when I was a medical student 25 years ago, we had to get vaccinated. And I think there are certain jobs where you have a duty of care to your patients, of course, and to protect yourself. And I think care home workers actually do fit into one of those categories. You know, of course, they don't have to be vaccinated, but then if they want to work in that job, they do have a duty of care to the care home residents that they're working with.
You don't worry. I mean, lots of people would say that that's a really slippery slope, because I worry about the slippery slope aspect of any compulsory vaccination like that. And yet at the same, and again, you know, you've taken a Hippocratic oath, you're in a profession, you've chosen that profession, and that's part of the deal, whereas these are often low paid minimum wage workers. And I do worry about that. And yet at the same time, I think it's, I would argue it's immoral if you're healthy and young and able to take the vaccine when you're working with someone who's frail and vulnerable who can't have the vaccine. It seemed to me to be immoral to do that job without making sure you took the utmost care for that person's health. It's a difficult dilemma.
It is difficult. And ideally, I know I would like to persuade everyone to take the vaccine. That would certainly be my preference. But if they're not willing to take it and they haven't really got a valid reason for not taking it, you know, what we don't want is, because of that person's choice, that someone gets infected and dies. And care home residents are the highest risk of dying. In the same way, we wouldn't allow someone, for example, not to wear gloves or not to wear a mask. I think it should be required to take the vaccine if they're not willing to be persuaded. But I agree with you, it's not an easy decision.
If they're not willing to be persuaded, if you're not willing to be persuaded... Yeah, he's all for the mandation. It's going to happen. The Telegraph newspaper this morning, it was their exclusive. They saw the documents. Hancock and Johnson want to change the law to mandate it for care workers at the very beginning. Interesting times. It's 5:30, by the way, or thereabouts. I'm looking forward to speaking with Jenny Lowes in the second hour. We spoke with her back in December. It was a fascinating conversation. So do keep that in mind. Reading more of your tweets as we go along. But I'm going to take another tune, because I feel like another tune right now. It is a Tuesday, whatever that means. And it's 5:00 somewhere in the world. Or 5:30. It's 5:30 here, isn't it? Richie Allen Show, live from Salford, Europe's most listened to independent radio show by a country mile. Thanks for choosing it. Archived on Podomatic, Spotify, iTunes, and anywhere else you get a podcast these days. This is Jamiroquai, by the way. Lots more news to come. And as I said, your tweets as well. Jamiroquai and Little L on the Richie Allen Radio Show. Let's go back to Downing Street momentarily, where the UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson is leading a briefing there on the 12-month anniversary, the year-long, the first-year anniversary, the first anniversary of the first lockdown, which is today. Johnson was asked about how the government plans to stop Europe's dreaded third COVID wave from coming to the United Kingdom. That is the standard of journalism in the world, not just in the UK. Journalists given little backhanders to lob softball questions at tyrants like Johnson instead of ripping him to pieces for the damage he has done to people's lives. They give him softball questions like, how's the government going to stop the third wave coming to the UK? Miserable bastards, every one of them that calls themselves journalists. Here's Johnson's answer in any case.
Yes, indeed. We must be very wary of the potential for a third wave. As Chris has just said, sadly, we're seeing on the European continent, we are seeing distinct signs of a third wave, and they're taking steps to abate that, to deal with that. And we in the UK have very tough measures at our borders already, including mandatory tests for anybody who comes here. You have to do a passenger locator form. You get fined £2,000 if you fail to fill one in. Then when you get home from wherever you have come from, you have to get a test on day two as well as day eight. And again, you can be very heavily fined if you fail to comply and you fail to quarantine.
There you are. Johnson there about the third wave and what might happen there. And what might happen is there might not be any holidays this summer. Watch this one closely. Time's at 25 minutes to 6 o'clock. The Richie Allen Show with me, Richie Allen. Going to be speaking with Jenny Lowes in the second hour. Keep those tweets coming in, by the way, as well. Let's move right on. No new normal. Ever. Lot of talk today. Let's listen to Nicola Sturgeon, Scotland's First Minister, or Jimmy Cranky to her enemies. Lucky to still have a job, maybe. Misled the Scottish Parliament over her role in the Alex Salmond affair, but found not to have done it deliberately. Might have dodged a bullet, Cranky there. Anyway, she stood up today to acknowledge the one-year anniversary of the first lockdown and had one or two interesting things to say. No return to normal. She talks about that. First of all, though, she's very grateful for everything and everybody. Jimmy Cranky.
Officer, for all these reasons, one of my overwhelming emotions on looking back over the last year, which is why Richard Holloway's remarks resonated so strongly, is gratitude. I will never be able to thank people enough for the sacrifices made and everything that has been endured over these past 12 months. But in addition to gratitude, I think all of us should feel a sense of resolve, perhaps politicians in particular. As we recover from this pandemic, as we will, we must create a better and a fairer country for everyone.
Better and a fairer country, right?
The way in which people have responded to the pandemic has been defined, as I've said, by solidarity, compassion, love and sacrifice. But the way in which people have been affected has been defined by the inequalities that still scar our society. Inequality has massively affected people's quality of life during lockdown. And of course, deprivation has significantly increased some people's chances of getting COVID and of dying from it. None of us can be satisfied by the idea of returning to life exactly as it was before. That's why, for example, the Scottish Young Persons Guarantee makes it clear that our young people must not pay the price of this pandemic throughout their lives. All of them must get a fair shot at education, employment or training as they start out in life.
Okay, you got that right. None of us can be satisfied at the idea of returning to normal life exactly as it was before. Then she meanders into climate change. Listen carefully.
Scientists across the globe have developed vaccines at record speeds. Testing infrastructures have been established literally from scratch.
Cranky sees no irony in this. Scientists have produced vaccines at record speed. Testing kits have been produced from scratch. No irony, no sense of irony, does the ginger troll. None whatsoever. No sense of danger whatsoever. None. Record speed vaccines that were plunging into people's arms. Jesus, I wonder if that's the right thing to do. No, doesn't occur to her. Anyway.
People have changed their behaviour and their way of life at a moment's notice to protect and care for each other. Now, the conditions that the next Scottish Parliament faces will, I hope, be nothing like the ones we've encountered and endured in the past year. But that Parliament will have an even greater responsibility than this and previous ones to tackle inequality, to support economic recovery and achieve a just transition to a net zero society.
What was that? A transition to a net zero society. She was talking about the one-year anniversary of the first lockdown now, remember?
Inequality, to support economic recovery and achieve a just transition to a net zero society.
A just transition to a net zero society. Cranky means carbon, of course, carbon zero.
And if we, all of us, can summon just some of the urgency, resolve and solidarity we have shown in the face of the virus and bring that to bear in tackling these big issues and others, then I hope we can ensure that we don't simply return to normal,
yeah,
but instead we create a better and fairer normality for the future.
On these big issues we have to tackle, if we can bring the same sense of urgency that we had in dealing with the virus, new normal, take on climate change. Now, she's reading a script there. Those are not her words or her thoughts. How do I know that? Well, I know that because politicians all over the world are speaking in the same terms. Lockstep, we call it. New normal, build back better, fairer society. Bring to bear on climate change, the things that were successful in dealing with the so-called pandemic. Wow, fairer society. I suppose when everybody has got nothing, or sweet FA, then it'll be fair, eh? It'll be equal. Mad stuff. On the new normal stuff. I missed this yesterday morning, but it's worth playing for you now. The BBC breakfast programme, television programme, has a regular GP called Dr. Nighat Arif. I hope I pronounced that right, but I don't care really. Dr. Nighat Arif, I think is her name. She was trolled unmercifully yesterday for saying this. TV doctor, national broadcaster, she said this about the new normal. Doesn't sound good.
I definitely think our behaviour has changed. So we'll be elbowing each other rather than handshaking or kissing each other on the face, or probably even toe-tapping.
Toe-tapping. We'll be elbowing each other instead of handshakes and toe-tapping. That's going to be a greeting now. You'll extend your left or your right foot and tap the person in front of you, tap his or her toe. What the is going on?
I definitely think that face covering is going to be a part of our normal stay, because the vaccine also, yes, we know that it actually protects you, but our behaviour around viruses shouldn't change. We've seen the decline in norovirus, the flu virus, and we've also seen that people now actually feel a bit nervous. I can't imagine getting into a lift or the underground and not having face coverings on anymore. I don't know about you, but I think that sort of behaviour has to carry, because the way to drive down viruses within the community is always going to come down to hand washing, face covering, and keeping that physical distance from people.
She can't imagine ever again getting in a lift or going into an underground without a mask. That behaviour has to carry, she said, because we can drive down viruses that way in the future.
But if we are behaving and we are doing all the right things,
behaving,
I think we could have our nearest and dearest at home with us around Christmas
around
and New
Christmas
Year's.
Around Christmas and New Year's. If we behave and do what we're told, we might have our nearest and dearest with us this coming Christmas and New Year's. You have to pay attention to this, because this woman is a regular on national breakfast television. The UK's biggest breakfast television show is BBC Breakfast. I think only one time ITV beat it in the ratings. So it's the biggest programme. And she's there saying, can't imagine ever again not wearing masks in enclosed places. We've got to carry that through. We've got to elbow bump instead of shaking hands. We've got to toe tap. Got a toe tap. Who is this woman? You know, new normal. New normal is everywhere today. And a behavioural psychologist called Charlotte Hilton was on Sky News. She was asked by the host, Sarah Hewson, will we ever touch each other again? Or will we be too scared to have close contact in the future? Psychologist Charlotte Hilton.
Yeah, I was watching television last night and I found it really odd just to actually watch how close that some of the characters were to one another. And it felt really unusual. And I almost had this urge to want to say, well, you make sure you keep your distance from one another. It just felt very, very odd. So I think my own personal experience tells me that there will be, for a lot of people, a period of adjustment where it does feel very, very peculiar allowing ourselves to get closer, physically closer to one another again. There's no doubt that the vaccine rollout will help perhaps with our confidence and reduce some of our fears and anxiety around that. But I think certainly, again, because we've had to stay away from one another physically for so long, it will take a period of adjustment, I think, for us to feel a little bit more comfortable with being closer to one another again.
Are there any positive changes that we've made that might survive this?
But what's really curious is that public health professionals have been attempting to increase people's physical activity and the use of the outdoors for many, many years now, at least over 20 years of dedicated public health and psychology research. has been pumped into trying to understand people's physical activity behaviour and how we might encourage people to move more often and make better use of the outdoors. And what we've seen is during the pandemic that because the main thing that people can enjoy is walking outdoors or perhaps even starting to run outdoors, spend time with immediate family outdoors, there has been an increase in people's use of outdoor space and physical activity. And whilst we heard earlier Professor Whitty's concerned over increase in alcohol consumption, for example, and other ill health behaviours, my understanding is that there are also some examples of more healthy behaviours like increases in physical activity and outdoor space use that we might see stick, but that remains to be seen.
Charlotte Hilton, behavioural psychologist, speaking to Sky News a little bit earlier on. Let's go back to Downing Street, shall we? Shall we? You don't want to? And let's go back anyway, just for a moment, because Johnson is flanked today by Chief Medical Officer Chris Whitty and Chief Scientific Advisor Patrick Vallance. And they've been talking in the last short while, about the chances of eradicating coronavirus. What do they have to say? Let's listen in.
I regret to say that I think the chances of eradicating this disease, which means getting rid of it absolutely everywhere, are as close to zero as makes no difference. We've only achieved eradication of one disease, which is smallpox, with a phenomenally effective vaccine over a very long period of time, literally hundreds of years. So, others have come close, but it's very difficult. In terms of eliminating from the UK, this is a disease which is got most people...
It's not a disease. It's not a disease. You're listening to Chris Whitty, the country's chief medical officer, by the way, standing alongside Boris Johnson. I'm going to carry on here. I'm not going to interrupt it for too long. But it isn't a disease at all. If it's anything at all, and I don't know if it even is anything... It's a respiratory infection. It's basically influenza is what it is. Not a disease, right?
Effective vaccine over a very long period of time, literally hundreds of years.
Okay.
So, others have come close, but it's very difficult. In terms of eliminating from the UK, this is a disease which is got most people who have it have mild symptoms or in some cases no symptoms.
Unbelievable. Most people who have it, mild symptoms or no symptoms. Most people. The fucking bastard is even admitting that today on March 23rd, 2021 to a gaggle of useless journalists who won't take him to the cleaners. He's just admitted it again, that COVID is basically fuck all. The only people who should be scared of it are people that are already diabolically ill, seriously ill, or very, very, very old. As is the case for any other infection. He's admitting it. They're laughing in our faces, these people.
Can then transmit it. That makes it very difficult to find. We have good...
Listen again. You can't make this shit up.
In terms of eliminating from the UK, this is a disease which is got most people who have it have mild symptoms or in some cases no symptoms who can then transmit it. That makes it very difficult to find.
This is fucking vaudeville. This is vaudeville. They've wrecked the country. They've ruined the lives of millions of children. They've bankrupted people. They've destroyed people's businesses, their babies, the things they built up for years. Unemployment, record numbers, mental health, cancer operations cancelled. Hundreds of thousands, if not millions, will fucking die. And this dickhead has the fucking balls to address the UK media today and laugh in their fucking faces and say that this is a disease that most people who get only have mild symptoms or fucking none at all. You've got to look very hard to find it. He fucking said again. Listen to it again. I'm sorry for getting irate, but this is fucking shocking.
So, others have come close, but it's very difficult. In terms of eliminating from the UK...
This is horrendous.
This is a disease which is got most people who have it have mild symptoms or, in some cases, no symptoms who can then transmit it. That makes it very difficult to find. We have good vaccines, very good vaccines, but they're not 100% effective vaccines. We have good tests, but not everybody who needs testing is tested. We really would strongly encourage people to do that. I think everyone agrees we can get COVID rates right down.
Yeah. I don't need to tell you, not a single journalist in the room had the balls to ask him. So, yet again, you've told us, a year on from the first time you told us, this is an infection that doesn't do squat to the vast majority of the population, right? So what the fuck was the last 12 months all about then? You mad bastard. What was the last 12 months about? No. Not a dicky bird from the assembled media. From the mouths of babes, right there, this afternoon, Whitty said that no more than 5 minutes ago. It's just gone on the BBC News Twitter page. It's astonishing, this, isn't it? I can't get my head round it. I really can't. Julia Hartley Brewer had Professor Anthony Brooks on her programme today. He's a geneticist and a health data scientist. No more lockdowns ever, please, said Professor Anthony Brooks. You'll hear Julia Hartley Brewer first of all.
Are you worried now that we are in a situation where this is what we do now? A, if there's a pandemic of any kind, but B, more worrying to me, is this is what we do next autumn. I would not put money on us not being in lockdown this coming winter, because when in cases go up, as they will, I think there's going to be more demand for there to be a lockdown again.
Well, I worry about exactly the same. But there's another dimension to this, and I think the politicians and the public need to start thinking about. All respiratory viruses are in equilibrium with humans, right? They reach a level of infection and fatality that they essentially kill off the same number of people each year that get newly vulnerable to those viruses. It's a balance that we've lived with for years and years and years. If we start locking down, masking, socially distancing, all of these things we're doing year after year after year, those viruses aren't just going to fade away into the distance, into oblivion. They will fight back. They will become more virulent, more transmissible, all the respiratory viruses, not only coronavirus, to get back to the same equilibrium. So the harder we push to suppress these viruses, the harder they will fight back. That's just the way virus evolution works. So if we want to get back to a healthy society, a balanced society, and a free society, we really do need to not resort to lockdown as a first reaction.
Yeah, I'm going to play the witty piece again, and I want you to take it later on and play it to everybody. Everybody you know, I want you to play it to everybody you know, okay?
Very difficult. In terms of eliminating from the UK, this is a disease which is got most people who have it have mild symptoms or in some cases no symptoms who can then transmit it. That makes it very difficult to find. We have good vaccines, very good vaccines, but they're not 100% effective vaccines. We have good tests,
Most people don't get it. Those who do get it won't even know they've had it. It doesn't affect the vast majority of people. It's very difficult to find. Chris Whitty, the chief medical officer, saying today what he said 9, 10, 11 months ago, that coronavirus is nothing for anybody to worry about. This is the Richie Allen Radio Show. The time is 8 minutes to 6 o'clock. Back with more after this. Phil Spector's Wall of Sound, the Ronettes and Be My Baby. Came across that, of course, like a lot of people my age, watching Dirty Dancing. Indeed. Alrighty, I've got a few tweets there, we better read them. David says, either Whitty or Valance is on the board of the Gates Limited. I mean, who? Can't remember which, though. World Health Organization, I think you meant there, David. Thanks for that tweet. Some of you, when you write your tweets, I don't mean you specifically, David, think for a minute that I'm going to have to read them out, you know? Right. Frame the sentences with me in mind. Hear my accent in your head when you write these sentences. Alan in Liverpool says, Richie, will the virus mutate into one to combat blue face nappies? Did anyone hear Ferguson and Whitty on Radio 4 at 1 o'clock? He said he had COVID, but he still went a-bonking. What? Oh, yeah, that's right. Ferguson. Ferguson was exposed himself to somebody. He was having an affair, wasn't he? And he was in breach of guidance, of guidance, lockdown rules, and travelled outside the 5K distance and all of that nonsense. Yeah, okay. Again, think about me reading out your tweets when you write them, please. Please, just do that, please, for me. Thank you. Hi to Nikki Murray. How you doing, Nikki? Richie, just listened to what Chris Whitty, that's not how she put it, said, and I'm just livid. These effing bastards need locking up, says Nikki. Problem is, Nikki, nobody's going to do it. This is the thing. I am sure that there are any number of laws on the statute books in this country that have been broken by people like Chris Whitty, Patrick Vallance and the rest of them, and of course Boris Johnson and Matt Hancock. But it doesn't matter. Who's going to arrest them? Which court is going to convict them? The answer is none. It's not going to happen. Whatever truther fantasists say about getting these guys in court, it's never going to happen. And that's not me being negative. It's never going to happen. It's dreadful. Lucy tweets, now they are suggesting that this is how we should do it with every respiratory virus. Lockdowns, in other words. I hope some scientists start to come out and say how stupid this would be. Again, Lucy, they have come out and said it. We're back to the media again. For months and months now, even since the beginning, I would say since the beginning, scientists from very, very, very famous academic academies and institutions have come out and said that this is a nonsense. But they have been basically blacklisted by the UK media. For a short time, you would hear one or two of these people on talk radio, for example, but not anymore. They're all in tandem now, all of them. Okay, all the radio stations in the UK, all the broadcasters have now accepted, and they've been warned by Ofcom, which regulates the broadcast media, they've been warned not to broadcast false news or fake news about coronavirus. So the media now has given up on people like Carl Hennigan and others. And back 6-7 months ago, when people like Carl Hennigan from Oxford University was refusing to come on this programme because he was scared that he might be targeted for coming on this programme because of some of my previous guests, I said to him then and to others, pretty soon I will be the only place left in the UK where you'll get to come and speak your truth or say whatever it is you want to say. I didn't say that to be petulant, because I understand why these people would say, oh, Richie, your programme has a reputation because you'll interview anybody and I'm worried that I'll be attacked for coming on. I am not petulant. I totally understand that. But I've said to them, there will be a day, pal, where I'll be the only game in town. And not long after that day, there will be no game in town because this programme won't exist. The time to talk to people is now, not to say, oh, I'm a bit worried about my own reputation. That ship has sailed now, reputations. People's reputations don't matter anymore. Doesn't matter what people might say about you. We've got to talk about this stuff now. We've got to reach more people now than we've ever reached, because if we don't, this is our lives. This is our lives. This is what it's going to be like. And it's going to get worse, progressively worse, as time goes on. Dreadful. Dreadful stuff. Dreadful that Chris Whitty could go on to television this afternoon and admit that the whole thing is a fucking sham. Dreadful. And nothing comes of it. Nobody will take it on. Nobody. There isn't a news presenter in the country that has the balls, that has the ovaries to say tonight, listen, fuck the rules, to hell with Ofcom, I'm going to take this on. I'm not going to allow this. I'm not going to allow a quack like Chris Whitty go on the television and say, well, basically COVID is nothing, and let him away with it. I'm not going to do that. Rip up the copy. Throw out the fucking auto cue. Be done with it now. We're going to tell the truth tonight. Tonight we're going to address the nation and tell them the truth, that this is a fucking sham. Have some courage. Have the balls. Find it within yourself somewhere. Go back to your childhood. There might have been a time when you faced down a bully. Stand up to it. How could you look yourself in the mirror if you're a top presenter on BBC or Sky News and you go to bed tonight knowing that you didn't take apart Chris Whitty today? The time is exactly 6 o'clock. It's a minute past six. I'll be back with you in about 60 seconds. Plenty to come on the programme today. Jenny Lowes, a former NHS nurse even, who recruited overseas for the NHS. She's in private care these days. Brilliant on this programme back in December. I've invited her back again to talk generally about these issues because she's very, very bright and very articulate. She'll be with me in a few minutes' time from her home in Portugal. It is Tuesday's Richie Allen Radio Show.
Renowned healer Mark Bajerski travels the world to find the most unique and powerful crystals for self-healing. Since the ancient times, crystals have been used as healing tools. They hold a natural healing vibration and are highly charged in positive energy. Mark teaches how to channel the universal energy and transfer it to the crystal to activate its healing power. Each crystal is used for its unique ability to target a different physical or emotional challenge. Mark Bajerski is an author, healer, speaker, and founder of the Pure Energy Healing Academy. He shares powerful messages of inspiration and healing on his daily YouTube videos, reaching millions worldwide. Mark's crystals, healing oils, and incense sticks are most sought after by other healers. His collection is available online at www.markbajerski.com. His work is presented through Lemon House, a company that creates and curates consciously made gifts.
Now, welcome back to the program. I'm not sorry for losing it earlier on and raising my voice. It's probably not nice listening to the radio, to hear the decibels, but it's... I can't listen to that. It's very difficult to listen to that. I mean, it doesn't get any more blatant than what we heard a short time ago from the chief medical officer. It's as close to an admission as you'll ever get from one of these people that this is a plandemic, as it has been dubbed by whoever dubbed it that. It's the closest you'll ever get to it. And it's desperately difficult for me to listen to it. It really is. I'm not saying that if I was in attendance at Downing Street, of course they're not in attendance. The journalists are connecting via Zoom or another platform, a similar platform. It's not about screaming at these guys. You never raise your voice when addressing these people, of course, as a broadcaster or as a reporter. But you would just quietly take him apart at the knees, wouldn't you? Doesn't affect most people. Most people don't even know they have it, is that right? And it's incredibly hard to find in people, is that right? What's this been all about then? And you don't let him off the hook. You bury him. Without screaming, without shouting, without ranting, you bury the guy. That's how it should happen. And if any of the other reporters winging in via Zoom have any courage, they join in with you and you rip him apart. And you end it. It's like we've said 1,000 times on this programme. The media can end this in minutes. I can't end it. We've got a successful radio programme here. But in terms of the BBC, this is nothing. It's like a grain of sand on a beach. I can't end it. But if I was presenting the news at 6 o'clock this evening for the BBC, I'd end it. It'd be over. Finished. Gone. Back to normal. These people would be running for their lives. Not from a baying mob with pitchforks and torches. No, but from the police. They'd be running for their lives to try and get out of the country before they were arrested and charged with treason. Treason against the people of this country. And not just the arseholes here, but the Irish arseholes and the German arseholes. Germany put the country into lockdown again now for another month. Macron has done it in France. It's never going to end, no matter how many people wear masks, no matter how many vaccines get distributed. This is meant to go on and on and on until it breaks people. The Great Reset, the Fourth Industrial Revolution, whatever you want to call it, that's what it's about. Anybody who doesn't believe that now, or who says that's a conspiracy theory, who are you fooling? You're fooling yourself, you know. Susan tweets, Richie, the witty statement, or the twitty statement, she says, is enough for me now. I don't think you can reason with anyone who can't see through this thing. I'm tired of it. I will live my own quiet life now and ignore the madness. It's sad, but I will look after my own and we will enjoy being human. Thanks, Susan. And I've heard that from one or two people that are very close to me. They've said, Richie, we're going to have two societies. We'll have a society of outcasts, people who refuse to go along with it, and will get on with their own lives and let the others get on with theirs. And I could live with that right now. If you handed me that on a plate and said, Richie, you can have that. You can have that. You get to live kind of outside society. You still get to move around, do your own thing, but only with your own people. And so that vaccinated society does their own thing. I could live with that. I could take it right now. Oh, give it to me now. I'll take it. And run with that. At BBG Richie, if you want to drop me a tweet, type to Pauline Watkinson. I'm with you on witty, Richie. He should be struck off. Absolute disgrace, she says. Thanks very much, Pauline. I agree with you, 100%. He won't be struck off, though. Hi to John Heffernan. How you doing, John? Thanks. Hi to Katrina. Hi, Katrina. Hi to Neil Mills and to Patricia. Right, let's take a tune. And when I come back from it, we will be joined, you and me, we'll be joined by Jenny Lowes. And she was brilliant. And it'll be nice to catch up with her again and find out how she's getting on, all right? Okay, then. Second hour of the Richie Allen Radio Show, live from Salford on richieallen.co.uk. Lots of platforms as well. This is the real thing. And these are real times, right? You to me are everything. Jenny Lowe's on the other side of this. Thanks for staying with me. Can't you see? You to me are everything. The real thing and you to me are everything. 9.5 minutes past 6 o'clock, the Richie Allen Radio Show. Thanks so much for all the tweets this afternoon. Lots of tweets. I heard my first guest on national radio back in, it must have been November time, late November, early December, and she was brilliant, speaking on national radio about nurses not being too, well, not nurses having their doubts about the mRNA vaccines. Brilliantly articulate. In the end, they couldn't kind of wait to get her off the programme, I don't think. We spoke with her back in December. She is a former NHS nurse. She was working in the NHS, recruited for the NHS in her time, and educated overseas nurses on behalf of the health service. She's an expert and is in private practice now. Delighted to welcome back to the programme, live from Portugal, Jenny Lowes. Hey Jenny, welcome back.
Hi Richie, how are you?
I'm really well, thanks. I'm so glad you came back on, Jenny. How are things there in Portugal?
They're okay. Things are pretty calm, but we're still in peak tyranny, and everybody's wearing masks outside. We still have to wear masks to get inside anywhere. And the kids, only the primary kids are back at school. The older kids are not. So things are okay, but you know, it's kind of the same as it is in the UK, really.
Same here.
The vaccine rollout hasn't been quite as aggressive here as it has been. I think they've only vaccinated something like 270,000 people or something like that. So things are pretty much the same as they are everywhere, I think. It's just continuing on with the same theme as the whole last year, really.
Thanks, Jenny. When you say that it hasn't been as aggressive, do you mean that the Portuguese health authorities haven't been pushing it as hard as they have been in the UK?
Well, when they first started the rollout, they started at the beginning with healthcare professionals, and then they vaccinated, I think, like the over 80s. But it seems to have slowed down now. But it's on the media, it's the same, really. But they have been reporting about the issues with AstraZeneca, and they had paused the rollout of AstraZeneca for a little while. But I just don't think they have the resources to roll it out quite so aggressively as they have in the UK, or they're using a bit of caution in doing it. I'm not really sure what it is, but I think the organisation is not quite as, you know, big as it is in the UK with the NHS. It does have a National Health Service. I just think logistically probably it's not as easy either, because Portugal's a very spread out country. So I don't know really why they haven't vaccinated as many, whether they didn't have as many available doses. I'm not sure, but it's the last I heard it was about 300,000.
Wow. Jenny, a couple of things that I'd like to get your thoughts on this afternoon. The first one is news that the Prime Minister and the Health Secretary here have confirmed that they would prefer to change the law to mandate vaccines for people working in healthcare. That was an exclusive in the Telegraph this morning. It didn't come as any massive surprise, I suppose, maybe to you or to me. But your thoughts on it anyway, because I know you're very interested in this.
Well, I don't agree with any vaccine being mandated, to be honest with you, because I think it should be your own personal autonomous choice, like we discussed last time when we were talking about the ethics surrounding consent. And the RCN, the Royal College of Nursing, have said categorically at the moment, unless they've changed their stance, was that they don't support mandatory vaccination. They advise vaccination, but they don't support it. So, I mean, I don't agree with it. I don't know whether it's just more optics and they won't actually bring it in as a mandatory thing, because I think that they would have a huge exodus from the NHS and the care profession, and that's really not what they need right now. You know, the last time I read, there was 200,000 within the NHS that were refusing to have the vaccine or saying that they weren't going to have it. That's a huge amount of staff to lose or redeploy. And I just, you know, they're desperate for staff. Even before this pandemic, they had 40,000 nurse vacancies. So I can't honestly see how they're going to do it ethically and get it passed to be able to force people to have vaccinations. What they can do, of course, is they could make it a requirement of employment, and they could redeploy people so people could get moved out of areas that they're very experienced in into other areas where they're deemed at less risk. But I think generally nurses don't support mandatory vaccination. From, you know, the people I speak to, it should be autonomous choice. And our NMC code, the Nursing Midwifery Council code, states that we should ensure autonomous choice and that we should respect the wishes of the patients. So how can nurses do that? And if they're being forced to do something against their own will, do you know what I mean? I think it's a very, very shaky ground. And I don't know whether they're saying it, you know, as another way to turn public opinion against each other and just cause more division. That's what it seems like to me. You know, we've already got people blaming those that are not vaccinated for not getting back to normal already. And it's just causing more judgment and more stress. And I can't see how they can actually do it, to be honest with you. But it's a bit like the vaccine passport thing. You know, were they just threatening that so that people uptook the vaccine? And then they've done a U-turn on that and now saying that people can't go on holiday. So it's all very sinister and it's not very comfortable at all from my position to be thinking like that.
I can only imagine, and we might talk more about that and what it might mean for you, even in private practice. Today we've got Jenny Lowes on the programme. Jenny's done it all, worked as an NHS nurse, has recruited for the service and educated nurses as well on behalf of the health service. Done it all, as I said, in private practice now. 200,000 nurses or 200,000 staff in the NHS, as you've already said, likely to either be very hesitant or to decline the vaccine. Does that surprise you, or is that about right for you? What do you think?
Well, I think the uptake for the flu vaccine last year was something like 80%. So there are people that are willing to take vaccines within the health service if they are advised to do so. But from what I've heard from colleagues and from friends that are still working in the NHS, some have taken it willingly. But when I've spoken to them, it's quite obvious that they haven't done their own research and they haven't really understood exactly what they're taking. And I've seen this across the board as well with people that have been posting like on Twitter and on other social media channels that they clearly haven't been given the information to be able to make a true informed consent. And you were talking about laws earlier and about the way in which things stand. And there's a couple of cases that happened about consent in the last few years. And one of them was Montgomery. I don't know. Do you know this case?
I don't. No, I'm all ears. No, I don't know.
The case happened, I think, in 2007, but it only actually reached a legal decision in 2015. But it was a woman who was pregnant with gestational diabetes and her baby was big and she was quite of petite stature. And she had been advised to have a cesarean, but she decided that she would go ahead and have a normal birth, a vaginal birth. And the baby had shoulder dystocia and ended up with cerebral palsy because the baby had oxygen deprivation at birth. And she took the health authority to court. It was Lanarkshire Health Authority. And the obstetrician hadn't given that to her as a risk, that the dystocia would be a risk. So the court found that the doctor should have told her that that was a risk because it would have changed her decision and she would have had a cesarean.
Yeah.
And before that, the test was something called, it was the Bolam test, which was the doctor should disclose what a reasonable doctor would disclose to a patient. So it was very much based upon medical paternalism of what they would deem relevant for the patient to make a decision. But this case reversed that and it said that the patient should be entitled to know whatever they need to know to make a decision. So in terms of the vaccine, you know, I heard my sister is a paramedic and her 25-year-old crewmate went to a vaccine centre for a collapse and it was a collapse at the site of a needle. It wasn't anything to do with the vaccine. And while she was there, she was on duty. The doctor said to her, "Have you had your vaccine?" And she said, "No." And he said, "Oh, I can give it to you now if you want." So she had the vaccine And 4 hours later, she was in the back of her own crew ambulance on her way to hospital. Yeah, with a very fast heart rate, with a tachycardia, which stayed for 3 days. And I just don't understand how that leads to any type of informed consent, because one, she didn't have time to consider whether she definitely wanted it or not. And there was a little bit of like coercion and bias there because she was being put on the spot to take it. And, you know, I don't know how much people are being told about side effects. Like, I think once they realized that some people were having anaphylaxis, and it is still quite a small number, they started to ask people about allergies. But I don't know how much they're really going into details about side effects. And the usual side effects that they tell you about is that you might get a sore arm. You might have like muscle aches for a few days and a temperature, but they're not really telling people that, you know, that all the other myriad of side effects that you're seeing on the MHRA website. And what a reasonable person surely would want to know was all of the risks. You know, they used to years ago in consent, when they're consenting for surgical treatment, is that if it was 1 in 100 risk, then they should disclose it or more. But if it was less than 1 in 100, then they didn't need to disclose it. Now, obviously, that's changed with the new cases that have come through the courts. But if it was me and I had a, you know, 1 in 1,000 or 1 in 10,000 or whatever the risks are of a serious adverse effect, I'd want to know, because it'd make a huge, you know, difference to whether I was going to take medical treatment or not. And this is the thing with, like you were saying about, will they be forced to take it if they're working in the care sector? And that introduces a coercive factor that invalidates any form of informed consent. So I think they're on very shaky ground. And like I said this last time, even the people that are delivering the vaccine, I think they're on very difficult territory, because there could be, you know, huge fallout of this, especially as we don't really know the long-term effects of what may or may happen with, you know, pathogenic priming or disease enhancement.
And they're still in trial, aren't they? These vaccines are still in trial. Well, some of them are, until 2023. Jenny Lowes is our guest, vastly experienced nurse and educator. On that, loads of questions. First of all, your friend is okay, presumably, thank God. But did your friend have the AstraZeneca vaccine?
Yes.
You see, now this is the thing, right? I've made a point. Listen, I'm no angel. I'd be the first to put my hands up and say I'm no angel. I can rant with the best of them, and sometimes I never take liberties with the truth, but I can exaggerate from time to time. I can't exaggerate this potential problem with blood clots, particularly when a Norwegian doctor, you'll be aware of this, professor, last week tried to get information to the European Medicines Agency before they cleared the AstraZeneca jab as being totally safe. He said, I'm absolutely convinced the only thing that could have given blood clots to 3 health workers in Norway is the vaccine itself. It's obvious to me, I shouldn't say it's obvious, I'm not a healthcare worker, I'm not an academic, I really don't have any qualifications here. But as a journalist, there's something wrong with this jab. I think there is anyway. What do you think? Would you go as far as that?
Well, it's certainly causing a lot more reactions on the yellow card scheme than the mRNA one is showing, the Pfizer or the Moderna at the moment. It's certainly running at a higher rate. But there, you know, if you look at all the different conditions that have been reported to the MHRA, a lot of those could be explained by issues with coagulation, either with low platelets or coagulation factors that are causing bleeds. I've read quite a lot of reports about women that had gone through the menopause that then started bleeding after the AstraZeneca vaccine, and also that there's a higher risk of clotting. But the one thing that upset me a little bit about that, when they dismissed the claims that there was any link to blood clots, was that they said, you know, the incidence is below the normal rate in the population.
In the population, yeah.
But there isn't many people, unless they've got an underlying condition that means that their blood clots more easily, is that they develop either deep vein thrombosis or pulmonary embolism or lots of microthrombi, unless they've had a risk factor before. So they might be on the contraceptive pill, or they might have had a long flight, or they might have had abdominal surgery, or they might have problems with their veins, or there's lots of reasons. But to have something like that after a vaccine, when they haven't had any, you know, of the other risk factors applied, it should be taken really seriously. And, you know, we've heard a lot about an increased risk of strokes as well. And they're all thrombolytic diseases, you know. There's even some like ischemic bowel that was reported and lots of other things that could be caused by thrombosis. But they're saying that it was this specific type of thrombosis that caused this specific type of stroke. And it was very, very rare. But they're not looking at like the whole spectrum of illnesses that have been reported following the vaccine. So, you know, they have given a lot of doses of the vaccine, and they will say, you know, with any drug there are side effects and things like that. But to go, especially, you know, I've seen a lot of people saying that they're having the vaccine so that they can travel. To go to have a vaccine so that you can travel when your risk of dying of the disease is negligible,
yeah,
and then getting a vaccine injury, you know, that's, it's really, really serious. And the only contributing factor was the vaccine, then it should be taken seriously. But it seems like, you know, they're almost dismissing that. I saw Van Tam was talking about paracetamol and that, you know, if you read the insert of a paracetamol box, it lists all these things. And apart from the fact that paracetamol has been around for about 140 years and we've got loads of evidence of you know, side effects of paracetamol, and usually the side effects of paracetamol are because somebody has got an underlying issue, or they've taken too many, or they've been using it longer term, so they've overdosed on the dose, rather than just taking a one-off dose and then having a reaction. So they're using comparisons that just are not comparable. And then I heard Chris Whitty was talking the same thing about aspirin. And just to add that paracetamol and aspirin do cause a lot of problems. You know, they're not benign drugs. They have a lot of side effects with them, especially aspirin. Lots of people have gastric bleeds and problems with blood clotting and things like that after aspirin. So the comparison, it's almost like it's dismissing it, and they shouldn't be doing that. They should be tackling it head on, and they should be showing the facts so that people can make an informed choice. And there's so much misinformation on all sides. It's not just from their side. There's misinformation on all sides. It's impossible for people to make an unbiased decision. Yeah. It really is.
Yeah, there is. However important it is to have an independent media, the so-called independent media is beset with Muppets and morons who use clickbait techniques, claiming all sorts of ridiculous things, and it doesn't help, really. As you said, help people make an informed decision. Jenny Lowes is a hugely experienced nurse joining us live from Portugal. Great to have Jenny on. What about those, Jenny, who say, and I know this is not necessarily your area of expertise, but you do have a better informed opinion on this than I do. What about those who say that they should be sued jokingly, under the Trades Description Act, because they're not really vaccines, they're treatments, these things?
Yeah, I mean, I've seen, it depends on what your definition of a vaccine is, I suppose, because there are different definitions. But they're calling them jabs, aren't they, a lot?
Yeah.
I noticed that they call them jabs and not vaccines. But I kind of agree with that in a way. They're not the traditional form of vaccine that we're used to, especially the mRNA one. They do supposedly help you mount an immune response, but the mechanism and the way that it does it obviously is different. But yeah, I think there's just so much secrecy and fudging of the data and the way in which they're presenting the data, especially, you know, like this 90% efficacy or 95% efficacy. Actually, when you look at the numbers that they've based that on is a tiny amount of people. I don't know how there's any statistical significance in it at all. So effectively, we're really finding out the true response now. And one thing with vaccines that's always, you know, interesting to note is that, like, I had the MMR vaccine when I was a child, like most people have. But how do I know that the vaccine has protected me if I've never been exposed to measles? Do you see what I mean? So people are in the trial, they were given the vaccine, say, the non-placebo arm. I think the Pfizer one was something like 160 patients that got, or trial participants that tested positive with one symptom, and most of those were in the the treatment arm and few were in the placebo arm. But it's such a small number. What if those people that were in the placebo arm were just more likely to be exposed to COVID than the ones that were in the... Do you see what I mean?
Than the
non-placebo
absolutely.
Arm than the actual vaccine arm. So there's none of that information there. We don't know where they worked. We don't know what their level of exposure was. We don't know whether they were mask wearers. We don't know if they were, socially distancing. We don't know any of that. So the numbers are just like, they might as well pick them out of thin air, to be honest with you, in my opinion. I don't think, I read the results of the trial and I think, there isn't anything here that convinces me that it really is 95% effective because we just don't know.
And that's
we
a chilling thing, Jenny. What you just said there is a fairly chilling thing. It's a chilling reality. The trial is now, isn't it? I mean, that's what you're saying, effectively. The real trial is now.
And, the trial date doesn't finish until 2023. So we haven't got any long-term data. And the Pfizer data that I was reading earlier... It was within 7 days. So it's like 90% effective 7 days after the second dose. 7 days. Like, I went the whole of last year without catching COVID. So my immune system, was it 100% effective? Can I make that claim that I'm more effective than the Pfizer vaccine? It's just the way in which they present the data is very misleading. And, the mainstream media, Pfizer is 95% effective or AstraZeneca is this. And actually, I read today about the FDA in America. They're saying that the trial data was skewed and that it wasn't sufficient data for them to make their approval on. So that'll be interesting to keep an eye on and see what happens
there. Is this the same FDA that gave the AstraZeneca vaccine 100% efficacy? I think so. Am I right in saying that?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. That's ridiculous. I mean, that's ridiculous.
So I don't know. I don't know if everybody knows on your listeners, but there's a calculator that you can go on. It's called qcovid.org. And you can put in your details, your age, medical history, where you live, that kind of thing. And it comes up with a risk. And my risk, I calculated it earlier, was 0.0014%, which is 1 in 71,429 risk of dying. And risk of hospitalization was 0.027%. And I was reading today as well that the overall risk reduction based upon the cases that they tested in the trial is 0.4%. So my risk is already 0.014%, and I can reduce that by an extra 0.4% by having the vaccine. So for me, like, this is why I think a lot of healthcare workers are skeptical about it, because their risk is already very low, although they are more at risk of being exposed to patients with a high viral load. Their risk factors are probably still quite low, because as we know, the majority of the deaths have been in over 80s.
They have. Sorry, Jenny, just to clarify that, the healthcare worker might be more at risk of picking up something from a patient or a care home resident than they are of giving something to those people. Is that right?
I guess so, because they say that 85% and there's still a lot of debate over whether asymptomatic people can transmit anything, which, I would suggest that that's a no. Pre-symptomatic is a little bit different, but asymptomatic, no. So if a healthcare worker is feeling unwell, then they shouldn't be going into work. They should be staying at home. And, if they're checking their temperatures or... it should be enough to realise that they're not going to be at high risk. But if they're working with patients that have COVID confirmed and they have symptoms, so, they have a productive cough or they have a very sore throat or, there was some talk about the virus being found in faeces, if they're dealing with faeces and things like that, then obviously they're at higher risk. So really, this thing about preventing their patients from being infected is really the other way around that's more of a risk.
That's amazing stuff. Jenny Lowes is our guest. The time is exactly 27 minutes to 7 o'clock. Jenny, you can stay with me for another 15 minutes, can you? Because I have loads to ask you, if that's okay with you.
I can.
Great to have you on. And just to remind our listeners, if you're just joining the programme, Jenny is vastly experienced as a nurse working in the NHS, recruiting for the service and educating nurses overseas as well. She's in private practice these days. Brilliantly articulate. I'm not kissing your backside now or blowing smoke, but you obviously are.
So hey, you can't.
I'll continue. Well, of course, that's the reason I came across you in the first place, because you phoned in, or you didn't phone in. They contacted you, LBC, or it was LBC at the time, yeah. And that was a really interesting piece of radio. A few things to ask you. Dolores Cahill, Dublin professor, University College Dublin. The university, this is not for you now, Jenny, this is for the listeners. The university, as we learned in the last day or two, have basically dismissed Dolores, or they've announced that she won't be lecturing there anymore. Previously very highly thought of, has been on this programme. I like Dolores. I don't know if Dolores is right, because I'm basically a numpty who has got no medical qualification whatsoever. But I believe that people like her should be heard. You mentioned pathogenic priming. She gave a brilliant explanation of that to me on this programme, what it might lead to, what the mRNA vaccines might lead to. That is, you get the mRNA vaccine, and later on, at some stage in the future, your body encounters one of the naturally occurring coronaviruses, and then your immune system goes into overdrive. Now, I know, listen, being a nurse and being as qualified as you are is nothing to be sneezed at, but I have to acknowledge that you're not a virologist or an epidemiologist, but you're very learned and you're very well read. Do you, when you hear that, does that make any sort of sense to you? You mentioned pathogenic priming. Would that concern you?
Well, when they've tried to do previous coronavirus vaccines and they've done the tests in animals, the animal part of the trial, all the animals that were then exposed to the wild virus encountered a lot of problems. So I think it's something that we should be very aware of. And it's not just Dolores that's saying that. There is other experts that are saying the same thing. So like you said, I am not a virologist. I don't understand in as much depth as Dolores does. And I find her to be very educated and very, you know,
very personable.
Very literate when she talks. Yeah. And so I think that it's something that should be considered. And again, that's not something that's being mentioned at all. You know, I've heard various spectrums on that, like from total doom and gloom that we're going to have a real problem to, you know, it is a possibility that it could happen in a small number of people. But I hope it doesn't happen, because, you know, how many people have vaccinated now in the UK? It's a lot, isn't it?
Nearly 30 million have had at least one dose, apparently. They've really ramped it up in the last few days, haven't they? They've managed to get 800,000 on Saturday. The same again, I think, on Sunday. I find it very depressing, Jenny. You know, I run past the vaccination centre in Salford on Liverpool Street, and I just find it very depressing. And the reason I find it depressing is because it's so unnecessary. The people walking in there, they look fairly healthy, Jenny, you know. They look like they're not going to be too put out now if they get coronavirus. And I don't know if you heard any of the programme earlier on, but at the Downing Street briefing today, Chris Whitty, again, for the second time in 12 months, basically admitted, and I'm not exaggerating here, I'm not, he basically admitted that coronavirus is nothing to worry about. It astonishes
me. I heard that again, and it's like a repeat of what he said almost a year ago, the media don't seem to want to pick up on that or focus on that at all, and the government seem to want to let that run. So for whatever the reason that might be, there are lots of theories and lots of things that people are saying, but I think that people should only have a medical treatment or intervention based upon their individual risk. I think that blanket vaccinating everybody and just trying to vaccinate every adult in the country is not, you know, good public health, or it's not good resource allocation either, because when I shudder when I look at how much they've spent on the track and trace and on the testing program, and then now on the vaccine rollout. And, you know, supposedly we're in the middle of a pandemic, and you know, all the staff and resources that it must take to deliver these vaccines to people that aren't at high risk, that are actually at very, very low risk, you have to wonder if that's ethical as well, because resource allocation is it's an ethical concern, because the NHS isn't a finite resource. It's, you know, it has to be allocated appropriately. And we've got, what really upsets me is that I know personally of a lot of people that are having trouble accessing healthcare and getting diagnosis and getting interventions and treatment for other things, but they're being contacted daily to go for their vaccine or There's a big push on that. And I find that actually probably the most disturbing part is that we know people have died because they weren't able to access healthcare. We know that delayed diagnosis has an impact on mortality. You know, there's so many other factors that are just not being talked about. And, you know, we have to talk about those things in a public spectrum so that people can balance exactly what's been going on. And, you know, I've heard some really awful stories, Richie, about people that have really been struggling at home with different conditions that haven't been able to get the care that they need. And the other thing, of course, is the people dying and being alone in hospital really upsets me as well. I just can't believe that the NHS, I know that some people are being allowed now to go and see relatives, but there is, you know, there was a lot of people that weren't able to say goodbye to loved ones. And for me, like, death is just as important as birth, and the way in which we die is very important. And it, you know, as a nurse, you know, supporting somebody at the end of their life was a real privilege, and to have not have their family around them or their loved ones around them at their time of death is really saddening. And I just think it's going to cause a whole load of extra problems in the long term, because, you know, if I wasn't able to see one of my family if they were dying, I'd be absolutely devastated. And or having to FaceTime them, I mean, come on, it's not human, is it? Is that, where's humanity gone? That, I think that those factors upset me a lot. That
what would have happened last year if you'd still been employed? Imagine, I know it's very difficult to imagine, nobody knows what they would do, but if you were, let's say you were at Salford Royal Hospital last year, and you're there, Jenny Lowe's, with all your experience, and you see the things you've just described happening, how do you think you would have reacted, thinking back? How would you imagine that would have went for you?
Well, I like to think that I'd always be an advocate for the patient, and I would have fought tooth and nail. But I also know that the health service can be a bit of a toxic culture sometimes. And, you know, from management down, it would depend on exactly how, you know, it would roll out. But I think I would probably have ended up being sacked or resigned, probably.
Yeah.
Because I was never quiet when, if there was failings in care. Actually, part of my job was to review cardiac arrests that happened in hospitals. So after the cardiac arrest, I'd go and sit down with the notes, and I'd look through everything and see if there was anything that had been missed or things that had been mismanaged, and then we'd do an inquiry into it and see if we could change things. And also part of my role was to challenge the doctors as well, because I worked in critical care, but the team that I worked with was called critical care outreach. So we'd go and see patients that were sick in the ward areas to get them moved into intensive care. And quite often, you know, the patient had been mismanaged, or the doctors would want to do one thing, or they'd be insisting on a certain, you know, route of treatment. And we would have to be very vocal about that. And we had a lot of respect, actually, because they knew we were experienced nurses. Usually it was the junior doctors that we had a problem with. But I think I absolutely would have advocated for the patients. And I'm sure that there has been nurses that have been doing that. But I think, you know, sometimes it can be a very toxic culture. And, you know, I'm not saying that the health services haven't been stretched or they haven't seen patients, you know, with SARS-CoV-2 there at all. I'm not saying that. And I'm sure that some difficult decisions had to be made. But, you know, when I first did my nurse training, when I first got my first job, I'll just give you a quick example. We had a patient that had been in hospital for about a year and he was dying. And his daughter was getting married, and he was a lovely, lovely guy. And they couldn't get married in the hospital because she wasn't a patient. So they were getting married at a church. So we arranged it that we got him dressed in his suit. We dosed him up on morphine. We organized paramedics to come and take him to the church. The paramedics took him to the church, and he couldn't stand. So they had to, like, stand him up in his stretcher so that he could see her walk down the aisle. He saw her got married, and he came home. Came back to the hospital, and then all of the relatives came in afterwards. The daughter was in her wedding dress still, and he died that night without us even taking him out of his suit. And, you know, I think of the efforts we went to make sure that that man got what he wanted, which was to see his daughter get married, and that his daughter, I'm getting shivers now, and that his daughter also had her father there. It's completely unrecognizable from the stories that I'm hearing today from the NHS. And, You know, I understand that there were difficult decisions to be made and that there were restrictions put in place, but it just seems that it's lost all its, you know, human touch, really.
And it's a lovely story, that story you just told.
Yeah, I know, and it was incredible because from the ward sister down to everybody chipped in to help with that, you know, the paramedics, everybody, lots of people made that happen. And to think that, you know, there's people that have been dying completely alone is really, really, really upsetting.
It's dreadful. I like to think, look, I've only known you through social media and through you coming on the programme, but there's enough about you that I think you certainly would have been raising concerns last year. There's no two ways about that.
Most definitely.
Jenny Lowe's is our guest.
I've tried to raise those concerns with ex-colleagues as well. And, you know, they're a bit restricted to what they can and can't say because a lot of them had to sign non-disclosure agreements.
Yeah. The old NDAs. I mean, that's very wrong as well. But one of the things that governments have done, successive governments, it began under Tony Blair, it carried on under Brown and Cameron, is they've gone after whistleblowers big time in so many different industries. They've tried to basically make whistleblowing impossible in this country, and that's terrible, really. There should always be absolute total protection for whistleblowers, because when nurses and doctors come out and say, listen to me, there's something very wrong here, it's in the public interest, it should be protected. Let me ask you this, Jenny. You mentioned about all these vacancies for nurses, which of course there are. I know there are people listening to this programme who might be thinking about a change of career. No joke whatsoever. People in their 30s who might be thinking, I'm in trouble here. The NHS will want more nurses. This is going to sound like a really stupid question, the way I'm going to phrase it, but I'll go for it anyway. How difficult is it to become a nurse? What's the process of becoming a nurse?
Well, now it's a degree entry profession, so you need to have obviously A levels to be able to go, or an MVQ at a certain level to get into to be a graduate. But they have just started to introduce something called nursing associates, which are like, they're like the old enrolled nurses, really, that they removed and made them all retrain, and now they're bringing the nursing associates. But you can become a nursing associate I think with less qualifications.
So that's like a teaching assistant, then. Sounds like a teaching assistant, that, or a teacher's assistant.
A little bit. I mean, the enrolled nurses were, you used to have the registered general nurses and then you'd have the enrolled nurses. And the enrolled nurses was a quicker route of becoming a nurse, but there were certain things that they couldn't do and then they had to be overseen by a registered nurse. And so it's similar to like that. It's like a 2-year on the job like college time as well. So it's slightly easier to get in as a nursing associate than it is to get in as a nurse. I think I'm not sure about, like, if you've already got a degree, whether you can convert like with an extra part of your training. But, you know, I'm very proud to be a nurse. It was something I always wanted to do. And I do still think that, you know, it is a good profession to be in. But would I want to work in the NHS now? I don't think I would, because they are so overstretched in normal times, and also a little bit restricted in your practice, you know, because you're given guidelines that you have to work to. You know, you have NICE guidelines, you have the Department of Health guidelines, you have local policies and protocols, and there's not so much room anymore to act like as an autonomous nurse, really. But, you know, I think if people want to go into the care profession, nursing is still a very noble job. I think nurses have had a little bit of a bashing in the last year. And, you know, I understand why. But there are still amazing nurses out there that are doing the work day after day. And, you know, I think it is still a very noble profession to get into. The pay isn't great and the working conditions aren't great for actually the level of responsibility that you have.
I agree with that. Yeah, I know what the average salary is.
But it is a diverse job. You know, there are lots of different ways you can go. Yeah.
34 grand, is it, or something? I mean, considering the responsibility.
24.
That's the starting salary, is it? 24?
Yeah,
is it?
24 is the starting salary, yeah. When I graduated, it was 12.
Was it 12, was it? Well, you're giving your age away there. I can find out very quickly. Yeah, I can go back. I won't do that. But, because we shouldn't see it as a vocation. But I remember interviewing nurses when I started my radio career back in the late 90s. So there might be an issue in the national news about nurses. So we would have a nurse on. And nurses at that stage would say to us, they would say, Richie, you know, while on some level for me it is a vocation, our employers should never be allowed to treat it as a vocation. And I agree with that wholeheartedly. If there's a vocational element to it, you know, if people are drawn to it because of a natural inclination to want to help and to heal, I understand that. But employers shouldn't take advantage of that, is what I mean.
I think you have to be a certain person to be a nurse, you know, and it's not an easy job, but it's a very rewarding job. I mean, I enjoyed every single minute of my nursing career and I enjoyed working with the NHS. I did see a change like from the late 90s to the mid like 2000s. Things really, when you said like with Blair coming in, they made a lot of reforms.
Yeah.
And that's when things started to go sort of downhill a little bit in terms of being a little bit choked in a way in the environment that you were working in, to use your clinical judgment as you should be able to in that, those situations. But they took a lot of the powers away from the ward sisters. They took the matrons away and then they brought the modern matrons back. You know, there was lots of things that they did. But, you know,
can I ask you, Jenny, can I ask you on that? Sorry to interrupt you, because this is really important and we've only got a couple of minutes left. You say this and it came in under Blair, the box ticking and all of that. I wonder, I've had people on this programme for years and they believe in the whole privatised by destruction model. Do you have any sympathy for the opinion that this was, even if Blair didn't do it or even if Blair didn't know what he was doing, that the service was destroyed, or it isn't destroyed yet, let's hope it isn't destroyed, but that there was some attempt to ruin it in order to bring about privatisation?
Oh, I think parts of it have already been privatised. I mean, when I first started nursing, you know, all hospitals had their own linen room. They had their own cooks that cooked in the canteen. They used to cook all the food on site. They had their own cleaners. They had all of that. They had, the hospital ran everything. And now a lot of those contracts have gone outside. So a lot of hospitals don't have their own laundries now. They don't have their own cooks. You know, a lot of the food that comes in is like super microwaved high meals and things like that. So they've already kind of started privatizing parts of it. And, you know, the primary care has also started to be privatized a little bit. And I always thought it would be a terrible thing for the NHS to be privatized. But now I wonder whether it might be a more efficient way to spend public money is to not privatise the whole thing. And the NHS should always be free at the point of care. I don't think people should have to pay for care.
For any service. But
the way in which they run the services, I don't know. I mean, the NHS seem to be wasting a lot of money right now.
Yeah.
Of public money. And, you know, are we getting value for money out of the what's being spent? Because there's a huge amount of wastage. I mean, even just in procurement. And recruitment, you know, I worked in recruitment and the amount of money that they spend on overseas recruitment is less than training a nurse from scratch. But the amount of money that they spend is unbelievable, really.
Jenny, do me a favour. Whenever you've got something to say, come back here, will you? Don't wait to
I've
be asked.
I've always got something to say, Richie.
No, I know you do, yeah. But no, do come back. Don't wait to be asked. You're an expert and your opinion is valuable. And these days it's not so easy to attract people to the programme because, I mean, you know, you've seen people have come on the programme and then they've been attacked for coming on because of some of the guests I've had on in the past. So fair play to you for doing it. There's always a risk in speaking to the independent media. But Jenny, I love having you on. Folks, you've been listening to Jenny Lowes. Jenny's in Portugal and she has been an NHS nurse. She's recruited for the service and has educated nurses overseas on behalf of the health service. Is in private practice today. Fascinating conversation, Jenny. Thanks for your time, and I mean it, the door is wide open to you.
Well, I'd love to come back on and speak about health, actually, like ways in which we can help ourselves.
I know, we said this last time, didn't we? Well, let's do that then. Let's get a date and sort that out. I'd love to have you talking about that.
Okay, nice to speak to you, Richie.
Brilliant to have you back, Jenny. Thanks for that. No, we will do that. We'll get Jenny. I think we said that at the conclusion of our last conversation back in December. I'll make that happen. Jenny Lowes speaking to the programme from her home in Portugal. Thanks so much to her. It's 7 minutes to 7 o'clock. Okay, right. I wanted to play this again. I know. I can obsess me. I can obsess on things when it's warranted. I think it's warranted here. I want to play you that smidgen of the Boris Johnson briefing from Downing Street. which took place. It began at 5 o'clock, ran for about 25 minutes to a half an hour, maybe a bit more. Flanked he was by Chief Medical Officer Chris Whitty and a scientific goon, Patrick Vallance. Let's hear this from Chris Whitty. Again, it's very important that if you're on terms with somebody, if you're not like cats and dogs with somebody, but if you're on terms with them, if you're getting along even though you disagree about what's happening, if you're on terms with them, play them this and ask them to consider it. Don't ram it down their throats. Ask them to consider it. Just listen to this.
The chances of eradicating this disease, which means getting rid of it absolutely everywhere, are as close to zero as makes no difference. We've only achieved eradication of one disease, which is smallpox, with a phenomenally effective vaccine over a very long period of time.
Okay, so it's the next bit, right?
Hundreds of years. So, others have come close, but it's very difficult. In terms of eliminating from the UK, this is a disease which is got most people who have it have mild symptoms, or in some cases, no symptoms, who can then transmit it. That makes it very difficult to find.
Okay, let's hear it again, right?
It's very difficult. In terms of eliminating from the UK, this is a disease which is got most people who have it have mild symptoms, or in some cases, no symptoms, who can then transmit it. That makes it very difficult to find. We have good vaccines, very good vaccines.
Mm. And that's the thing, as Jenny said on the programme only about 15 minutes ago, this claim was made by Whitty back in April, I think, of last year. Coronavirus is nothing to worry about. And you think about that and then think about everything that has happened since then and think about everything they are proposing from this point forward. The tyranny, the totalitarianism, give it whatever name you want. Think about all of that, where it's meant to go, and then think back to what he just said there. Most people get mild symptoms. By the way, that's most people who get coronavirus. When Whitty spoke about this nearly 12 months ago, he said that most people won't get coronavirus to begin with. Most people won't get it. Of those who get it, most will get mild symptoms. Many will have no symptoms at all. You think about what's happened since then and what's to come. Yeah. Thanks a million to Jenny Lowes, who spoke to us from Portugal. That's the experienced nurse. I really appreciate that. I like Jenny and I hope she comes back on again. I will make that happen. Jenny to talk about health in general. I think she's got a lot to say on that. I will make it happen real soon. Early April, let's say, we'll get Jenny back on if she's amenable to early April. Dr. Thomas Binder will be on the programme tomorrow night. German doctor whose career was destroyed by the German authorities because he started screaming from the rooftops last year that the whole thing's a hoax, that the virus is nothing to worry about, lockdowns kill people, the vaccines may very well do great harm. He was destroyed for saying that. He's back on the programme tomorrow in the second hour. Later in the week, the great Dr. Paul Craig Roberts has not been with me for ages. Paul will be back with me tomorrow, Thursday, I should say. A busy old week on the programme. Thanks for your company today, and thanks for all your messages and tweets and all of that. Thanks again to Mark Bajerski. We've had a couple of hundred new supporters to the programme who've sent support to the show to take part in that draw, which I'll make on Friday. Mark has got 50 care packages, which he's given to the listeners of this programme most generously. Everybody who sent me an email, everybody who said, Richie, here's some support for you, put me in the draw. Rest easy, you will be in the draw. You'll be in the draw, and I'll announce the winners on Friday or Saturday. Thanks for listening today. Bye for now. Speak tomorrow. Bye now.